discuss in the Upanishads and Mahabharata before I introduce him. Next week, about at the same time, at the same venue, Reni Dilage, also from SOAS, will be speaking on pilgrimage as a geographic ritual in South Indian Hinduism. And she is actually focusing on Ayyappa kind of tradition, which is kind of new growth around the Sabarimalai pilgrimage center. So please do try and make it next week. Okay, today it's Brian Black's day. Brian is actually, he has worked under some distinguished people, as he just mentioned, my own Professor Lawson, and Julia Leslie, very well respected Indologist. And his doctoral thesis, which I read very enthusiastically, is an exceedingly well analyzed, well-written stuff on the Upanishads, trying to look at its socio-cultural kind of history and to unpack some of the issues. I suppose he might touch on some of them today. So Brian, you're most welcome to this center. And today's topic is female speakers in the Upanishads and the Mahabharata. And there is a little abstract, if anyone wants to quickly take a look at it. I'll just pass it around. And so, Brian?
Yes, thank you. So I'll just kind of reintroduce myself a little bit to contextualize what I'm going to talk about. As Professor Kumar mentioned, I did my PhD on the Upanishads, basically taking a kind of narrative approach, trying to understand the philosophy in the context of the narrative sections of the stories, see what kind of impact the stories have on understanding the philosophy. I'll touch on that a little bit in this paper, but it's one of the chapters in my thesis in taking this approach was focusing on the female characters in the Upanishad. And so that has kind of led me into what this paper's about, because currently I have a kind of postdoctoral position at SOAS on a project on the Mahabharata, which is entitled Epic Constructions, Gender, Myth, and Society in the Mahabharata. So in a sense, my kind of first move in trying to do research on the Mahabharata is to take a theme that I've already kind of worked with in the Upanishads and start moving into the Mahabharata. This represents some of my initial steps in doing that. And so at the end, we'll see that I'm kind of more looking ahead towards the things that I hope to do rather than things that I have done already. So I will just begin reading the paper. This paper will explore modes of address and behavior among female characters in the Upanishads and Mahabharata. Despite the discursive authority that is generally denied to female speakers in Brahmanical literature, the Upanishads and Mahabharata nevertheless construct a number of strong female characters who are often given authority indirectly, thereby implicitly presenting a number of specific ways of speaking for women. We will begin with Gargi in the Upanishads, who presents Yajnavalkya with his greatest challenge during the Brahmodya in King Janaka's court. Not only is this one of the first literary episodes that presents a female character discussing philosophy in ancient India, but also there are a number of specific aspects of Gargi's character that are shared by female characters in the Mahabharata, including Draupadi, Shakuntala, Damayanti, and Sulabha. Throughout this paper will explore the situational and contextual dimensions of what female characters say, exploring the social roles constructed for women. The status of women in ancient India and the portrayal of women in Brahmanical literature has been a topic of much debate. A number of the first scholars to approach this subject attempted to argue that women enjoyed a relatively favorable position in ancient India. Altakar, for example, argued that the position of women was higher in ancient India than in ancient Greece and Rome. Similarly, R.C. Dutt claimed, "No nation held their women in higher honor than the Hindus." Uma Chakravarti recently has argued that this trajectory of scholarship was part of the Indian National Project, which attempted to assign a high place for women in the ancient Hindu past. As she says, "The analysis of the position of women in ancient India has also been colored by the fact that almost all the works have been written by scholars who would fall within the nationalist school of history. Writing at a time when Hindu social institutions were being subjected to fierce criticism by a generation that was imbibing Western education and Western values, these scholars worked hard to show that the position of women had been high in the ancient past." More recently, feminist scholars like Findlay have attempted to characterize the quite positive portrayal of female characters like Gargi in the Upanishads as representing an era of unsurpassed advantage and opportunity for women. However, it is impossible to assess the actual situation facing women in ancient India, and we must keep in mind that the utterances of female characters like Gargi and the ones we'll be looking at in the Mahabharata are not the direct expressions of a female authorial voice. As Jameson, Stephanie Jameson, reminds us, we are never hearing women's voices directly. From the beginning, we must face the fact that we are not going to hear an authentic woman's voice, or at least not without tampering by those who have inserted it into the tradition for their own purposes. In this paper, I will look at narrative scenes in the Upanishads and Mahabharata where women participate in discussions about philosophy or about Dharma, examining how female voices are represented and how interactions between men and women are described. As we will see, these scenes both characterize the participation of women as vital, as well as attempt to limit and control the extent of their participation. Importantly, although the speech and actions of female characters continue to be controlled by and mediated through men, we also see that a number of ways of speaking and acting are specifically associated with female characters and contribute to new kinds of constructions of female subjectivity. Rather than attempt to explain away these contradictions, it is important to recognize this tension in the portrayal of women, especially the female characters, as a significant aspect of the text. As Jameson explains, the conceptual position of women in ancient India was by nature not unified, not governed by a coherent set of principles and attitudes. It was contradictory, and these contradictions found both in overt statements and in attitudes covertly reflected in narrative and ritual are irreconcilable. Before we turn specifically to the narrative scenes that feature women in the Upanishads, let us first look at the narrative context of these episodes within the literature of the Brahmanas and Upanishads. Elsewhere, I have argued that the narrative sections of these texts, the Upanishads in particular, are fundamental to understanding their ideological claims. The narrative sections do not merely introduce and frame particular teachings, but they give us a context for the philosophical ideas. Like the dialogues of Plato, philosophical claims are introduced in the form of a conversation, thereby presenting philosophical ideas with the context of specific individuals and social situations. They tell us who is speaking, to whom, where, under what conditions, and what is at stake in their discussions. When we pay attention to these details, we can see that the narratives not only contextualize the teachings, but they also characterize the knowledge and outline how and by whom these teachings are practiced in the social world. The Upanishads are well known for exploring ideas related to the self, the body, life, and death. While these teachings emphasize the Atman, The dialogues reinforce this focus on the individual by presenting us with specific selves, the literary characters. In this way, the specific characters and how they achieve selfhood are an integral part of the Upanishadic discourses about the self. The Upanishadic notion of self is not merely a philosophical insight, but a way of being in the world. Primarily, the Upanishadic narratives present knowledge of Atman as largely restricted to Brahmins, and the social situations where Atman is discussed are fundamental events in establishing an identity within the Brahmin community. Additionally, the Upanishadic narratives address the Brahmin's dialogical partners. In order for Brahmins to achieve their goals in this world and the next, they have to enter into dialogical relationships with others. The two groups of people whose participation is necessary both for Brahmins to earn wealth and status in this world and immortality in the next are kings and women. Kings are important because they are the Brahmins' employers. Kings reinforce the authority of Brahmins and even give them a political importance. Women are necessary for Brahmins primarily as wives and childbearers. They are represented and defined in ways to ensure that their role in reproduction will produce male offspring, which is considered necessary for the immortality of Brahmin men. Importantly, for both kings and women to participate as dialogical partners, there are aspects of Upanishadic discourse that they are expected to know. Thus, in addition to Brahmins, kings and women also have access to Upanishadic teachings. However, the extent of their participation is quite different from each other. Kings are presented as knowledgeable in Upanishadic learning with access to immortality. Women, however, although their presence is necessary, only have restricted and indirect access to the Upanishadic goals of self and immortality. As we will see, the extent to which women can fully participate in philosophical discussion in the Upanishads, indeed in the Mahabharata as well, is a subject that is explored in a number of different ways. Nevertheless, throughout their dialogues with both kings and women, Brahmins model their relationship in ways that reinforce their superiority as Brahmins. Elsewhere, I have defined four different kinds of dialogues in the Upanishads, all of which feature at least one Brahmin character. However, what distinguishes the different types of dialogues from each other is the Brahmin's different dialogical partners. The four different types of dialogues are discussions between 1. Brahmins and their students, 2. Brahmins and other Brahmins, 3. Brahmins and kings, and 4. Brahmins and women. These four distinct categories of dialogue illustrate that as the dialogical partners change, so do the dynamics between individuals, as well as the practices that accompany the discussion and what is at stake for Brahmins. Additionally, these four types of dialogues represent four different social situations, all of which are fundamental to forming the identity of Brahmins. The first category represents education and how one joins the Brahmin community. The second type of dialogue features debate and addresses how Brahmins establish their reputation and their relative hierarchy among each other. The discussions between Brahmins and kings are about patronage and how Brahmins earn wealth, accommodation, and even political power. The fourth category between Brahmins and women is how Brahmins set up a household and secure immortality through progeny. Importantly, all of these different social situations represent fundamental aspects of a Brahmin's life. Now that we have reviewed the kinds of narrative situations in the Upanishads, let us look more closely at those scenes that feature female characters. In particular, one scene that features Gargi Vachaknavi. As we will see, her words and actions illustrate that gender is an essential aspect of philosophy in the Upanishads, both because of the explicitly male soteriology represented by a number of the teachings, as well as because the genders of the literary characters have an impact on what they say and how they interact with each other. Gargi is the woman who figures most prominently in philosophical discussions in the Upanishads. She appears in the well-known scene in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, where several Brahmins from Kuru Panchala appear in the court of King Janaka to challenge Yajnavalkya and his claim to be the superior Brahmin among them. Of all the opponents of Yajnavalkya, Gargi emerges as the strongest, displaying her knowledge both through her understanding of the discourse as well as her employment of a number of debating tactics in placing herself on the on the winning side of the debate, although indirectly. As we will explore further, a number of specific aspects of this scene are shared by scenes that feature female speakers in the Mahabharata. Gargi is singled out from the other Brahmins because she is the first challenger whom Yajnavalkya threatens. Additionally, she is the only opponent who challenges Yajnavalkya twice. In her initial confrontation with Yajnavalkya, Gargi begins her questioning by asking about the foundation of water. Yajnavalkya, tell me, since this whole world is woven back and forth on water, on what then is water woven back and forth? This question begins a verbal exchange in which Gargi continues to ask about the foundation for every response that Yajnavalkya gives. Finally, when Yajnavalkya replies that Prajapati is woven back and forth upon the worlds of Brahman, Gargi once again demands a further answer and asks, on what are the worlds of Brahman woven back and forth? At this point, Yajnavalkya warns her that if she continues to question him, her head will shatter apart. He says, don't ask too many questions, Gargi, or your head will shatter apart. You are asking too many questions about a deity about whom one should not ask too many questions. So, Gargi, don't ask too many questions. Here, Yajnavalkya uses a well-known phrase, mate murda vipaptat. This phrase appears on a number of occasions throughout the later Brahmanas and early Upanishads, and it is particularly connected to narrative scenes that depict the Brahmodya, or philosophical debate. Insler suggests that there are two scenarios in which this threat appears. The first is a threat where one opponent warns another that they are speaking beyond their knowledge, and if they do not stop, implicitly conceding their inferior knowledge, they will suffer the consequences. The second type is when one opponent concedes defeat in an argument, prompting the victor to proclaim that if they had not conceded, then their head would have shattered apart. In both cases, it is clear that the one who employs these words is accusing their opponent of speaking beyond their knowledge. Insler suggests that Yajnavalkya's warning to Gargi represents the first type of threat, because it is clear that Yajnavalkya accuses Gargi of asking beyond her knowledge. Although it is true that Yajnavalkya makes this accusation, there are a number of details in the narrative that suggest that Gargi is not speaking beyond what she knows, but that Yajnavalkya is merely employing a threat as a means to silence her. One reason to call into question Yajnavalkya's accusation is that Gargi speaks a second time. She is the only speaker who challenges Yajnavalkya more than once, and her second challenge suggests she is confident that she is safe from her head shattering apart because she does indeed know what she's talking about. Additionally, when Gargi speaks again, she appeals to an audience, which is a tactic whereby she calls attention to her interactions with Yajnavalkya. Indeed, as we will see, appealing to witnesses is an important debating tactic employed by other female speakers speaking in the court of a king. When Gargi questions Yajnavalkya the second time, at first she does not address him directly, but rather appeals to all the other challengers. Distinguished Brahmins, I'm going to ask this man two questions. If he can give me the answer to them, none of you will be able to defeat him in a theological debate. Significantly, she pays her respects to the other Brahmins by referring to them as distinguished, Bhagavantaha. She does not refer to Yajnavalkya by name, nor does she speak to him in a respectful way. Rather, she simply refers to Yajnavalkya with the personal pronoun imam. Assuming that Yajnavalkya silences Gargi the first time, not by his display of Upanishadic knowledge, but by personally bullying her with threats, then it is not surprising that Gargi is appealing to the other Brahmins to be her witnesses, so that Yajnavalkya does not employ any more debating tricks. Once she has the attention of the Kuru Panchala Brahmins, Gargi appeals to the truthfulness of her speech. Significantly, this is similar to the Satya Kriya, which is also a technique employed by other female speakers. In his article on the Brahmodya, Thompson defines the Satya Kriya as a formal utterance, in some ways akin to a vow, by means of which usually extraordinary or magical ends are accomplished. The Satya Kriya is used by both men and women in Vedic literature. However, in the Upanishads and later literature, the Satya Kriya becomes a debating tactic especially employed by female characters because they do not have the same discursive authority that Brahmin and Kshatriya men enjoy. In Gargi's case, she has neither the educational lineage nor the patronage of Janaka to give her words the same power of persuasion as Yajnavalkya. She thus needs an audience to bear witness to her truthfulness. Another important debating tactic that Gargi employs is that she assumes a masculine mode of speaking. After the Brahmins encourage her to ask her questions, Gargi then addresses Yajnavalkya directly. I rise to challenge you, Yajnavalkya, with two questions, much as a fierce warrior of Kashi or Videha, stringing his unstrung bow and taking two deadly arrows in his hand, would rise to challenge an enemy. Give me the answers to them. By comparing herself to a warrior and positioning herself as a direct combatant to Yajnavalkya, Gargi's challenge is aggressive and shows the competitive atmosphere and high stakes of the Brahmodya. Even though Yajnavalkya has just accused her of ignorance and threatened that her head will shatter apart, Gargi remains undaunted and clearly sees herself as equal to Yajnavalkya. Additionally, Gargi's use of this trope of combat shows that only when she adopts an aggressive and confrontational approach to debate is her argument taken seriously. In other words, she has to take on the rhetoric of a Brahmin male subject to pose a serious challenge to Yajnavalkya. Similarly, Gargi adopts Yajnavalkya's characteristic use of humor in an attempt to unsettle Yajnavalkya himself. After her aggressive challenge, Gargi asks Yajnavalkya her first question. The things above the sky, the things below the earth, and the things between the earth and the sky, as well as all those things people refer to as past, present, and future, on what, Yajnavalkya, are all these things woven back and forth? Yajnavalkya's response is that they are all woven back and forth upon space. Gargi responds to his answer by praising him. All honor to you, Yajnavalkya. You really cleared that up for me. Get ready for the second question. This response is seemingly respectful. Yet, when Gargi delivers her second question, it becomes clear that her praise was actually mocking Yajnavalkya, as her second question is exactly the same as her first. Olivelle has remarked on the acerbity of Gargi's second question. I think that Gargi's response is dripping with sarcasm. She is not satisfied at all with the answer and is telling Yajnavalkya, in effect, to get serious. This, I believe, is the reason why her second question is a repetition of the first. This is significant because even though Gargi does not end up defeating Yajnavalkya, she openly defies his authority by mocking him in front of the assembly. In fact, her mocking praise suggests that perhaps her first question was also posed ironically. Her question is about the foundation of the sky, the earth, the things between the sky and the earth, the past, the present, and the future. In her initial series of questions, Gargi also asked about the ultimate foundation for all things. She continued to ask on what the worlds of air, Gandharvas, and the sun was woven back and forth. In this case, however, rather than ask about the sky, earth, past, present, and future as separate questions, Gargi asked about the foundation of everything at the same time, perhaps attempting to avoid Yajnavalkya's seemingly infinite regression. If her second challenge is basically a restatement of her first line of questioning, then essentially Gargi asked the same questions three times. If this is the case, then Yajnavalkya's initial refusal to answer her casts into doubt his own knowledge. Although Gargi does not have the authority to directly threaten Yajnavalkya, when she responds to his answers with flattery, only to ask him the same question again, she shows that she is still not satisfied with his answers. Another aspect of this debate that marks Gargi as superior to Yajnavalkya's other, more conservative opponents is that she is the only one who is not directly silenced by his words and manages to get the last word herself. Every other encounter between Yajnavalkya and his opponents ends with Yajnavalkya making the final point. The text marks these occasions by telling us that the challenger falls silent or becomes quiet. In Gargi's second challenge, however, she does not become silent after Yajnavalkya's final point, but once again addresses the entire assembly. Distinguished Brahmins, you should consider yourself lucky if you escape from this man by merely paying him your respects. None of you will ever defeat him in a theological discussion. Gargi is the only participant in the discussion to employ the term Brahmodya, and with this short speech and warning to the other Brahmins, Gargi gets in the last word in this exchange with Yajnavalkya and consequently does not completely give in to his authority. By explicitly naming the discussion a Brahmodya, Gargi inscribes her own presence and voice within a discursively sanctioned activity. Importantly, she never admits that she is convinced by his answers, but only that she recognizes his superiority over all the other Brahmins. She positions her own authority with Yajnavalkya's ability to defeat the other Brahmins, indirectly situating herself on the winning side of the debate. Consequently, despite not winning the debate explicitly, Gargi manages to put her own frame around their argument and to align herself with the victor. As the one who pronounces Yajnavalkya as the superior orator, she claims the authority to pronounce the winner. Another feature of this debate that Gargi shares in common with other female speakers in ancient Indian literature is the intervention of an authoritative male speaker. As we have seen, Gargi challenges Yajnavalkya on two separate occasions during this debate. Her second encounter, however, is only made possible due to the intervention of Uddalaka Aruni. Importantly, Uddalaka joins the Brahmodya at precisely the moment when Yajnavalkya threatens Gargi, offering a counterattack in which he challenges Yajnavalkya with the same fatal consequences of his head shattering apart. It is only after Uddalaka intervenes that Gargi resumes her debate, and it is at this point when she specifically appeals to the other Brahmins to bear witness to her arguments and make her prediction about the outcome of the debate. In this episode, we have seen that Gargi poses her challenge to Yajnavalkya not only by what she says, but by how she speaks and how she conducts her arguments. Specifically, she appeals to the truth, addresses the assembly, employs sarcasm, and adopts an aggressive mode of address. By speaking of these debating techniques, by means of these debating techniques, she both displays her knowledge of the practice of the Brahmodya as well as proves her superiority over the Kuru Panchala Brahmins. These debating tactics put her on the winning side of the argument, yet her victory is only established indirectly and her eloquence is not specifically acknowledged. Despite Gargi's strong challenge to Yajnavalkya, one of the central issues in Gargi's participation in this Brahmodya is the lack of authority of women's speech. In the case of Gargi, the text undermines her authority by the fact that any success against Yajnavalkya is muted and indirect. Although her words are shown to be true and prophetic, there is no explicit acknowledgement of her achievements. Nevertheless, at least Gargi's participation itself is acknowledged, as she is the only woman who is physically present at the debate. There are, however, indications that other female voices are also represented in the discussion, although indirectly. Similar to when Gargi captures Yajnavalkya's attention by adopting the mode of address of a male warrior, these other women are only heard after their voices have been filtered through the identities of male subjects. As Grace Jansen has pointed out, when men control the discourse, there are severe limitations on the representation of female subjectivity. There can be no women subjects, she says. Women qua women, therefore, cannot speak. When women speak, when women take up subject positions, it is not as women, but as imitation males, as men in drag. In the Upanishads, we see that on a number of occasions women do speak, yet the authority for female speakers is continually denied. In the Brahmodya in King Janaka's court, Gargi is the only woman present, but hers is not the only female voice that is represented. There are two cases in this scene where female voices are mediated through Gandharvas. When challenging Yajnavalkya in Janaka's court, both Buju Lahayani and Udalaka Aruni preface their questions with an account of visiting the Brahmin teacher Patanjala Kapya in Madras when they were wandering students. Buju recounts that Patanjala had a daughter who was possessed by a Gandharva. In Udalaka's account, all the details are the same, except that in this case it is Patanjala's wife who is possessed. In both cases, a female character is named, but any speech associated with them is attributed to a Gandharva. One of the crucial questions regarding these curious episodes is whether or not the daughter and the wife visibly assume the form of a Gandharva, or if they look the same and act as ventriloquists for the voice of the Gandharva. In both episodes, these women are described as Gandharva Grihita. The Sanskrit term Grihita means to be grasped, taken, or seized, and Monier Williams defines Gandharva Grihita as to be possessed by a Gandharva. However, in these passages, we do not know exactly what this means. Do Patanjala's wife and daughter retain their own physical appearance, or do they assume the visible characteristics of the Gandharva? Unfortunately, it is impossible to answer these questions. Significantly, however, Buju and Udalaka do not merely recount learning from a Gandharva, but both of them specifically mention the identities of the women who are possessed. In this way, the identities of the women are considered necessary details in the narrative, yet the agencies of these two women as speaking subjects are completely denied. Keith briefly acknowledged the possibility of attributing the speech of these Gandharvas to the women they possessed. He said, "Women are not excluded from contests. A maiden seized by a Gandharva shows herself an adept in Upanishadic knowledge." Additionally, Roebuck, more recently, has suggested that in these episodes, the women act as oracles. Gandharvas have a special connection with women throughout Vedic literature, most notably the Gandharvas Vishvasu, who was known to visit brides on their wedding nights. Because of this already established connection, the presence of the Gandharvas in these episodes in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, rather than hide the original speakers altogether, emphasize their gender as female. In the context of the debate in Janaka's court, these discourses, which have been ventriloquized through women, serve as important challenges to Yajnavalkya. This is especially the case with Udalaka's challenge, because his counterattack is delivered with the threat that Yajnavalkya's head will shatter apart if he does not know the discourse. Thus, it is Patanjali's wife's discourse, ventriloquized through the Gandharva, then repeated by Udalaka, that Yajnavalkya has to prove that he knows if he wants to avoid his head shattering apart. Nevertheless, although these discourses are linked to female identities, Patanjali's wife and daughter are not acknowledged as speakers. In fact, their speech is doubly removed. It is both attributed to the Gandharvas, and also the Gandharva speech is recounted by eminent Kuru Panchala Brahmins. While the episodes featuring Gandharvas illustrate the lack of authority for female speakers, Gargi's participation in the Brahmodya highlights a number of debating tactics that women use to make their voices heard and to accomplish their objectives. Turning to the Mahabharata, we will see that a number of the narrative scenes featuring female characters contain some of the same elements found in Gargi's encounter with Yajnavalkya. In this section, I will concentrate on four characters, Draupadi, Shakuntala, Damayanti, and Sulabha. All of these characters argue eloquently in matters of Dharma and or philosophy, yet all of them have the truthfulness of their words questioned and in various ways depend upon a male authoritative voice to authenticate their words. Draupadi is the most prominent female protagonist in the Mahabharata. Her most consequential appearance is during the dicing match between Yudhishthira and Shakuni in the court of King Dhritarashtra. She is summoned to the court by an usher who informs her that she has been staked by Yudhishthira and that she now belongs to the house of Dhritarashtra. Significantly, Draupadi refuses to go and quite shrewdly poses a question concerning the legitimacy of the stake. She instructs the usher to go back to the court and ask in front of the entire assembly, "Whom did you lose first, yourself or me?" It is notable that this scene takes place during Draupadi's period of menstruation. Manu suggests, or as in the laws of Manu, states that men should not carry on a conversation with a menstruating woman. Thus, by refusing to go to the court, she is both questioning the dharmic status of the dicing match, as well as reinforcing her own adherence to Dharma. Although Draupadi shows herself to be knowledgeable of Dharma, it is not clear whether she could have anticipated the implications of her question. Nevertheless, her question about Yudhishthira's right to stake her creates a moment where Dharma is subverted and destabilized. Duryodhana responds to Draupadi's question by sending his brother Dushasana to physically drag her into the court so that she could ask the question herself. Cleverly, after she is dragged by her hair, molested in public, and humiliated with abusive language, she apologizes for not having paid her proper respects to her elders upon entering the court. She says, "I have a dharma more pressing, which I could not perform before, confused as I was by this strong man who dragged me about forcibly. I must greet my betters in the assembly of the Kurus. Let it not be my fault if I did not do this before." She then describes herself as a dutiful wife who has been confined to her home, not seen by either wind or sun since her marriage. Here Draupadi has changed her tactics. Rather than continuing to question the dharmic status of Yudhishthira staking her, she is now appropriating the language of dharma to emphasize her own dharmic behavior. It is notable that Draupadi's argument involves the most restricting aspects of her dharma as a wife. Nevertheless, she succeeds in diverting the attention from the legitimacy of Yudhishthira's stake to her own adherence to dharma. The narrative, in fact, does not return to her initial question, but rather relies on the intervention of King Dhritarashtra, who grants her 3 wishes because of her eloquence in dharma. Although the narrative does not explicitly provide an answer to Draupadi's question, by means of the 3 wishes, Draupadi is implicitly victorious in her argument. The 3 wishes give her the authority to decide the outcome of her dilemma. A further indication of this interpretation is provided by her response to the 3 wishes. For the first wish, she chooses the freedom of Yudhishthira. Draupadi justifies this decision as for the sake of her children. Her second wish is for the freedom of her 4 other husbands. Significantly, however, she declines her 3rd wish. Her refusal to accept a 3rd wish further illustrates that she was already free. Similar to Gargi, Draupadi is depicted as arguing eloquently and tactically in front of a predominantly male audience. Yet despite displaying her knowledge of dharma, her objective is achieved only with the intervention of the king. A similar scenario appears in the story of Shakuntala. In this story, Shakuntala lives in an ashram in the forest with her father, Kanva, who is a renowned ascetic and scholar of dharma. King Dushanta visits the ashrama one day to pay respects to Kanva, but the sage has gone out. Instead, Dushanta encounters Shakuntala, is struck by her beauty, and asks her to be his wife. She does not refuse the offer, but suggests that they wait for her father to return so he can give her away. Dushanta, however, quite urgently suggests that there is no need to wait for her father, because Shakuntala can give herself away. He subsequently quotes the 8 types of marriage and suggests that they can be married by the rite of the Gandharvas. Shakuntala, however, only agrees after stating her terms and conditions. She demands that any son born from their union, will be the rightful heir to the throne. Thus we see Shakuntala as an astute negotiator who is learned in dharma. This knowledge of dharma is important, again, when Dushanta has betrayed his word and does not send for her or their son. Dushanta has betrayed his word and does not send for her or their son. Consequently, Shakuntala must go to the court and ask the king to accept her and her son. Dushanta, however, despite privately acknowledging that he remembers her, claims not to recognize her and calls her an evil ascetic. Interestingly, the text then focuses on Shakuntala's presence of mind, informing us that, although inspired by her anger, she checked her expression and controlled the heat that had been accumulated by her austerities. She then proceeds with her argument, pointing out that Dushanta is not only lying to her, but to himself and indeed the gods and the entire assembly. Thus, her first tactic is to appeal to the assembly as a witness to the king's lack of truthfulness. At this point, she employs the well-known threat of head-shattering, saying to Dushanta, "If you do not do my word as I am begging you, your head will burst into 100 pieces." Interestingly, despite threatening the king and despite the fact that the king himself knows the truthfulness of her words, this threat does not prompt him to admit the truth. Rather, he continues to deny knowing her and blatantly accuses her of lying. "How do I know that this is my son? Women are liars. Who will trust your words?" Finally, Shakuntala runs out of patience and concludes her argument by returning to the issue of truth, stating that truth is the highest dharma, and then walking out of the sabha. However, upon leaving, there is an intervention, this time from the gods, who instruct Dushyanta to reject Shakuntala. The narrative justification for this intervention is that the king needs to clear himself of the suspicion of his people. Implicitly, Shakuntala is proven true to her word, and thus, similar to Draupadi, she is involved in a discussion where the conflict is resolved in her favor. However, in both cases, their victories are undermined by the fact that they were insulted, and both ultimately need the intervention of a male authoritative voice to vouch for the truthfulness of their words. Damayanti is another female character who relies on an authoritative male voice to authenticate her words. That Damayanti needs this authorization is particularly surprising, because the truthfulness of her words is highlighted throughout her appearances in the story, as she twice employs the Satya Kriya, or truth act. On the first occasion, she makes a vow of truth to outwit the gods at her Svayamvara. In this case, Damayanti intends to choose Nala, with whom she has already fallen in love. However, the gods are also in love with Damayanti, and they attend her Svayamvara disguised as Nala. Thus, when Damayanti enters the arena, she sees five men who look exactly the same. She uses the power of truth to oblige the gods to reveal their identities. She says, if it be true that I choose Nala to be my husband, then by this truth the gods must point him out to me. If it be true that I have never strayed in speech and thought, then by this truth the gods must point him out to me. Damayanti uses this power again when a hunter attempts to take advantage of her. When the way of words had passed, indeed she cursed him in anger. No sooner had she spoken than the hunter fell lifeless to the ground, like a tree caught on fire. In both cases, Damayanti invokes a power which she has generated by her own speech and actions, with the narrative quite explicitly connecting the gods' revelation of their divine form and the death of the hunter to Damayanti's agency. Yet, despite the power of her words being established in these scenes, her truthfulness is not completely accepted when she is reunited with her husband at the end of the story. Oh, sorry. I thought that was an objection. Because she is called for a second Svayamvara as part of her plan to find her lost husband, Nala, Nala questions whether she has promised herself to someone else. Despite giving her word, she relies on an intervention of the wind god to prove to Nala that she has spoken truthfully. Damayanti's situation is different from both Draupadi's and Shakuntala's insofar as she does not present her case to the king in the sabha, but rather in the woman's quarters, and she does not engage in an argument about dharma. However, this episode has an important similarity with the situation that faces Shakuntala. Not only do both women speak eloquently, but they say words that the audience knows are true. We as the audience know that Dushyanta should believe Shakuntala, and we know that Nala should accept the words of Damayanti. However, clearly this was not sufficient from the point of view of the composers of these narrative episodes. The speech of women was considered inherently questionable. Thus, despite the power of her word displayed in her actions of truth throughout the story, Damayanti's loyalty to Nala is only accepted when it is verified by the gods. One of the most fascinating episodes in the Mahabharata, where a woman debates in the sabha, is the dialogue between King Janaka and Sulabha in the Moksha Dharma section of the Shanti Parvan. This encounter not only contains a number of elements similar to the accounts of female speakers that we have looked at thus far, but also explores some of the obstacles facing female speakers in a number of different directions. There are several aspects of this dialogue that mark it as distinct from the others we have examined. In addition to emerging as the clear winner of the argument, Sulabha is characterized as adept at yoga and as one who has attained moksha. All of these characteristics are quite rare for a female character in Brahmanical literature. Another interesting feature of this scene is that Sulabha, using her yogic powers, enters the body of Janaka and conducts her entire argument while inhabiting the king. These features contribute to exploring familiar tropes like appealing to an audience and ventriloquism in different directions. At the beginning of this scene, Sulabha is a wandering ascetic who hears reports from other renouncers that King Janaka has achieved moksha without giving up his kingdom. Doubtful of these claims, she uses her yogic powers to cast off her body, put on a flawlessly beautiful one, and travel to the court in the wink of an eye to find out for herself about the king's claims to be enlightened. When she arrives, after accepting the king's hospitality, she challenges the king to an argument in front of the assembly. Importantly, at this point, she uses her knowledge of yoga and enters into the king's being with her being. This marks the beginning of their debate. Janaka speaks first, stating that he has achieved moksha, and invoking his teacher to support this claim. He then poses a series of questions to Sulabha about who she is. Where have your homeless wanderings taken you, blessed woman, and where will you go? Whose are you, and where are you from? I cannot get a clear sense of your learning, of your age, or of your ethnic group you were born in. Indeed, Janaka returns to these questions throughout his argument, challenging Sulabha's own claims to achieving moksha by questioning her social identity in terms of caste, family, and gender. On one occasion, he specifically questions how she can be an ascetic when she is so youthful and beautiful. Sulabha responds by outlining the characteristics of a proper argument, and then addresses Janaka's question of who she is from a completely different perspective than the way in which the king posed his questions. Rather than speak of herself in terms of her social identity, she talks about her selfhood. She discusses the 20 components that are responsible for the origination and passing away of beings. She explains that there is an unmanifest prakriti that becomes manifest in the 20 components. And she outlines the stages of bodily development, including the different stages of the fetus. Thus, in her argument, she goes from the general to the specific, arguing that if the king were a truly enlightened being, he would not have been concerned with her social identity, that his question of who she is, from the point of view of an enlightened person, can only be discussed in terms of the combination of the 20 components and cannot be answered in terms of one's social identity. From this perspective, she poses the question to Janaka. Since you see yourself within yourself by means of yourself, why do you not, in exactly the same way, by means of yourself, see yourself in someone else? Thus, Sulabha argues that if Janaka were truly enlightened, as he claims to be, he would see no distinction between himself and Sulabha. Much of the debate revolves around the curious circumstances of their encounter. Janaka accuses Sulabha of inappropriately joining a man and a woman of different social orders, and claims that she has broken a number of social taboos by inhabiting his body. According to Janaka, she has crossed distinctions of both caste and gotra. Furthermore, Janaka argues that one who is unenlightened should not be joined with one who is enlightened, and Sulabha should not give herself to another man if she already has a husband. In this final accusation, Janaka suggests that there is a physical dimension to her inhabiting his body. Indeed, throughout the dialogue, both characters allude to a sexual dynamic to their encounter. For example, Janaka argues that one who carries the triple staff should not steal love, and he makes a comparison between their encounter to a man and a woman who desire each other. He says, when a man and a woman desire each other and each gets the other, that is like nectar. When they do not get each other, or when one feels no passion, then that failure is like a poison. Throughout her rebuttal, Sulabha denies all of Janaka's accusations. Most importantly, she argues that because of her yogic powers, she can dwell inside him without touching him. And thus, there is no actual mixing or merging that is going on. Furthermore, she challenges Janaka's claims about her social identity. She claims that she is not a Brahmin, but a Kshatriya, that she is not unfaithful because she has no husband, and that she is the one who is enlightened, and that if he were enlightened, she would not have been able to inhabit his body in the first place. And finally, that if Janaka were truly enlightened, these caste distinctions would not matter anyway. At the end of the argument, she declares that she will dwell in him for one more night, like a mendicant dwells in an empty house. So, how are we to understand the curious circumstances of Sulabha's inhabiting Janaka's body? In terms of Sulabha's argument, her entering Janaka makes perfect sense because she truly illustrates that there is no real distinction between them. Additionally, we see an inversion of the ventriloquism featuring the Gandharvas, whereas in those instances the Gandharvas serve to mask or subvert the identity of the female speakers. Here, Sulabha's yogic powers and status of an enlightened person are highlighted by her ability to enter the body of Janaka. Furthermore, there are important gender implications in her philosophical conclusions. Sulabha, through both her arguments and her actions, represents a model for enlightenment that is beyond the dualities of gender distinction, and therefore as available for women as for men. In looking at this dialogue between Sulabha and the king, we have come full circle. We began with Gargi debating against Yajnavalkya in Janaka's court, and with Sulabha we return to Janaka's court as she debates directly with the king. Indeed, throughout these narrative episodes in the Upanishads and Mahabharata, we have seen that there are a number of similarities regarding the restrictions facing female speakers and some of the same tactics they employ to circumvent these restrictions. What do these situations tell us more generally about the Upanishads and Mahabharata? Why are there so many strong and articulate female characters when contemporaneous Dharma texts clearly restrict women's roles in matters of Dharma and philosophy? These are questions I hope to explore more fully in subsequent research.
Thank you, Brian. Right on the box. Floor is open. And questions, comments?
As you were talking about Sulabha, I came to my mind those scenes in some of the Mahayana Buddhist sutras where there is a discussion where you should have a goddess, a human, if you're so clever, then why a woman? And there's this change of roles and the whole query about what is it to be either, and in terms of that. I don't know whether that's occurred to you.
It hasn't, and I would like to look into that. I'm finding more and more that there are connections worth exploring between things that occur in the Mahabharata, and especially the Puranas in Mahayana literature. And I think that that's a relatively unexplored area generally, but I think that that's a good point.
But you obviously have to be followed up, see whether there were any.
Yeah.
Certainly, as you were talking, I thought, this is just, that's the same sort of thing is going on.
Yeah. But I find this dialogue, I mean, a lot of people have written about this, or not a lot, but I mean, recently there have been a few articles about this dialogue, and I think people try to grab onto it as like, and try to generalize the quite positive role that is depicted for Sulabha. And I think it's important to recognize that, but she's not representative of most female characters in the Mahabharata. I think it also somehow makes more sense in the Moksha Dharma section of the Shanti Parvam in the Mahabharata. I this is something that is much more of a hypothesis at this point, but it seems to me that there's a lot of stories and teachings in that section that like somehow fit together quite well, but are more different from, say, some of the more dominant ideologies that are in the Mahabharata and other places. You were going to say something.
You've obviously focused particularly on humans, even when they're possessed by Gandharvas. What about goddesses? I was once at one time very interested in Durga's interventions in the Mahabharata, which are relegated in the critical edition, but I think are actually ancient. And I just sort of found myself wondering about, whether you're interested in expanding into that.
I think I need to, and I think that especially because a lot of the female characters are quite explicitly linked to a number of goddesses. The way I've come in to this research through the Upanishads, which is primarily about humans, or even when it's about gods in kind of more human-like situation, I think that is much more of the focus that I brought into this work. But I think that's a good point. And that's why I wanted to, you know, perhaps I didn't make clear enough that Gargi is the first, you know, human female to engage in philosophical discussions in a kind of debate-like situation. But, you know, we even have these kinds of dialogues going on in the Rig Veda. But I would argue that they're quite different in kind.
Just a minor point, I'm curious about the female Gandharvas, Gandharvis, I suppose, are they? And apsarases, because often you get male Gandharvas providing music and female apsarases doing the dancing, and it looks as though they're lovers and or siblings or something, it looks as though they're very closely linked. You don't seem to hear so much about female Gandharvas, let alone male apsarases, who I think are non-existent. Have you any thoughts on that area?
Yeah, I mean, I always just assumed that Gandharvas were male and apsaras were female. Mm. I mean, there might be some places where that's not true, where there's actually female Gandharvas, Gandharvis. But I don't know of those contexts. I've always assumed that one was a group of male deities.
Yes.
And yeah. Does anybody know of that?
In the order of the creation, which you would find either in the Manu's text or even in the other, the Upanishadic text and so on, they are classed as, some places they are classed together with the humans. But they are somewhere in between the gods and the humans.
Mm, mm.
They're kind of celestial beings.
But are they distinguished in that way that Gandharvas are male and apsaras are female, or are there, can you have like both sexes of both? I mean, it's one of these things that it's like you just kind of assume something, and then it's only when somebody asks the question you think, oh, wait, maybe that's not, maybe it doesn't quite work that way.
Is maleness and femaleness appropriate of those?
It seems like it is, because because the way they interact with the humans and the way they interact with each other, it seems that this kind of, you know, gendered aspect of their identity is very important.
Can I ask about it? You get such a lot of, some of these seem to fit into the cheeky female sort of type, which you see such a lot of, and it's interesting to have this notion of truth sort of added on to that. There's such a lot of sarcasm with female characters throughout Kavya, throughout the Puranas. And it seems to fit terribly well with quite a lot of characters. I mean, Sita, Radha, Parvati, we all have situations where it seems quite a trope where the female is saying, well, you know, how dare you? How can you doubt me? And we know we have this wonderful sort of narrative situation. We know that it's true, and we see them struggle. And the struggle of the sort of oppressed, excluded female is dramatized, and then we get this sort of release at the end where we all realize the truth and it's all all right. It doesn't work out quite as well for Sita. And it's interesting here that it's being attached to quite an explicit truth discourse in a very social, concrete way. I like to see this as this exciting drama of the sort of excluded person and the different discourses of truth that they can use to bring themselves up. Does it ever apply to anyone who's an excluded group other than the women? I mean, is the caste or other situations that you know of?
I mean, that's, again, something that we hope, I mean, my colleague and I hope to explore in our project, because we're also looking at kind of caste issues, especially castes that are not Brahmins or Kshatriyas. But as far as I know, there's no... I haven't encountered some Shudra in a philosophical debate or in a Dharma debate. So, like, there are characters who appear, and they appear in... But not, I don't know if they have as much dialogue associated with, you know, I don't know if they have manners of speaking, and, but again, that's something that would be very important to look into.
Just related to that, we get all these wonderful cheeky, these eloquent females, and then these cheeky females, and does it ever go a step further, and you get really naughty, mendacious females who appeal to truth, but are actually not in the right.
Right, right. Not that I've encountered. Not that I've encountered. But that, again, that... I mean, this is... as I said, this is just the tip of the iceberg, the very beginning. And that's why, in a sense, I focus on pretty obvious female characters in the Mahabharata. They're not ones that no one's ever heard of or anything like that. But these kinds of questions I'll be trying to look at.
Let me add a few words. Because you see, women and Shudras were considered on the same level since the injunction is Nastri Shudrau Vedamadhiyata. And in the Chandogya Upanishad, there is this specific instance of ascertaining the caste of Jabala Satyakana. Only on ascertaining that he is not a Shudra, only on ascertaining that he is a Brahmin. Actually, there is no evidence to that effect. When he approached his mother and asked, to whom I am born, of course, Jabala was not able to answer. He returns to his guru and tells him that this is what I have been told by my mother. Then he can say, oh, you came back and told me the truth, therefore you might be a Brahmin. Then only ascertaining his Brahminhood that he accepted him as a disciple. So, yeah, no Shudra cannot be seen in any of the Upanishads or in the...
Well, but I do think that one of the interesting things is we have these statements that sometimes in the Upanishads and Mahabharata themselves, and sometimes more in the Dharma text, that say, you know, women can't do this, or women and Shudras can't do that. But then through the stories, we see that a lot of these kind of absolute statements are questioned, they're subverted. Now, that doesn't mean that actually there's just as many opportunities for them as everybody else, but it means that these kind of, like, grand statements of like, prohibiting people. One of the things that I find particularly interesting about that episode in the Chandogya Upanishad is that Satyakama's teacher, Satyakama comes to the teacher and he basically says everything that his mother has told him. And if you look at the lines, he says exactly the same words. And then he says, "Oh, you must be a Brahmin, because only a Brahmin could speak like that." And it's interesting surely if Satyakama's mother had gone up to him and said those same words, he wouldn't say, "Oh, you should be my student." But again, here's another case where the words are the same. And so it's not just about the words. It's not just about the truthfulness. It's about who's speaking them and in what situation they're speaking. Which I think both kind of opens up that dialogue in two directions. It both shows you like how it doesn't really come through with what it's claiming to come through with, but also shows that, well, perhaps if a woman could speak like that, maybe they're, you know, maybe you could take that interpretation as well. I actually think that interpretation is a little bit less likely, but nevertheless, it's opened up a little bit.
It was very nice presentation, and as one who is not only a Sanskrit teacher, but a person who has associations with social political activities. You see, I'm allowed to add a few more words. You see, even without doing much more research, one can reach the conclusion why in Manusmriti, etc., provided Nastri Shudrahu Vedam, Nastri Swatandriyam Arhati. You see, once women are given this freedom, what will happen? Clear evidences were presented. So, it happened so in the later times. And what the present situation is, I have penned a poem in Sanskrit, of which four lines I am just reciting with its English mean. Yatyurdhvamekatra daridrereka kurvandyathosya sahasralokan. On one side, the poverty line goes up, bringing beneath it thousands of people. Ambara chumbin onyatra gacchandyurtvam angida pancha nakshatra bhavanti te. And on the other side, big buildings go up and up and form five-star hotels. Tatra vikriyate gargi shakundala tira varangana chansikatapisa. And in such hotels, Gargi, Shakuntala, and our prestigious Rani of Chansi are sold out. Thank you.
That actually brings, I think you wanted to ask something else.
It was just one more question, not totally unrelated, but sadly not sung. It's all being recorded, so it's an appropriate time. It's always so fascinating, isn't it, the way the texts, and that you see it again and again in so many different kinds of texts, where they make these declarations. You know, one is forever talking about Manu and about the text of Dharma, and they're to an almost equal degree being questioned and subverted, and the cracks are being shown in all sorts of Sanskrit literature, and these are examples of this. But I have to finally ask the question, you know, is it an author who is aware of both sides and is a knowing and multifaceted author who says, here are the rules, and builds into that vision, here are also the different dynamics by which that can be deconstructed, and is in fact deconstructed, in fact, and often is justified in being deconstructed, or as a question of sort of form criticism of authorship, is it that there was, do you think it's that other subversive elements have been built into the text from other sources over time? I mean, for instance, is it that the Mahabharata is being added, subversive messages are being added to quite order-imposing messages in the course of time? Or do you think it's a comprehensive, coherent composition?
Or maybe order-imposing messages are added to subverted messages as well. I mean, certainly with the Mahabharata, I don't know anybody who can claim that it's one author. I mean, I think that the most scholarly opinion, you know, it's been composed over several centuries, and I certainly wouldn't counter that. But I do think that in at least most stages of the editorial process, that the people were the editors or compilers were extremely aware of the text, and I think that they in most cases had a sense of what of how what they were adding would change things, and that is in at least a lot of cases part of why something's added there and not somewhere else. And so I do think that, I mean, of course, I agree with the literary criticism. You can't only see it in terms of the author's intention or this in this case, the editor's intention. There are also meanings that only open up afterwards and in other times and other cultures and things. But no, I do think though that there is some level of some kind of intention of the editors at times, even though we can't always know who the editors were, or ever know where they were, or when something was added. I do think that in most stories it's worth looking at them as a kind of composite whole as they exist in the text. Yeah.
This Draupadi's polyandrous relationship with her five husbands, it seems like such an anomaly.
Yeah.
It just kind of, where does it come from and what happens
after
that? Because that's such an important story, but...
Well, there's a perfect example of why I had to interject that maybe something was more subversive and these kind of attempts to order them come later. I mean, I don't think anybody can answer why that's in the text, but it seems to be like one of the oldest parts of the story, you know, and that it's certainly that part you can't imagine being added later because it's so central to the five brothers and the relationship to each other. But we see that there's several explanations given for that situation, and those explanations don't always kind of fit together with each other. And you know, so the way I would kind of read that is that you just see that as this story develops in importance and is, you know, and is still in a vital story after generation, different audiences call out for an explanation because it doesn't, you know, they're not satisfied with that situation anymore. It, as you say, it seems like such an anomaly to them as well, and that's, so we need to, it needs to be explained in several ways. But I don't think we can say, well, we know that people live that way up in the hills at some time, or, and you know, that's where because, you know, after all, I think that these stories in some ways are really connected to real life. I think that they explore issues that were very real to people, and it's worth looking at these stories very closely to see what kinds of issues they're exploring. But there's another level to them that they're just stories. And that doesn't, and that, when I say just stories, what I mean by that is that not, like, not everything necessarily has to represent something that could happen in real life. And, I mean, like, an example for that, for what I'm saying there, is that there's been a lot of scholarly debate about these situations where people's heads shatter apart. And, like, there's one scholar who I quoted, Insler, who basically tries to argue that in these narrative episodes of the Brahmodiya, that nobody's head is shattering apart, that threat is metaphorical within the context of the story. Because he says, how could it be that somebody's head could shatter apart with mere words? And even though I think he's made some really good observations about these scenes in other areas, I don't think that you can make an argument based on that, because obviously these are stories written by Brahmins to show how great they are and how powerful they can be. So why couldn't they write a story where they shoot each other's heads off with their with their philosophical points?
On the subject of the polyandry of drug